Good morning and welcome to the KRFY Tuesday morning show. This is Julie Calamine, your morning show host, and today I'm joined by a favorite, one of my favorites to join us on the morning show, TJ Ross, who is the Regional Communications Manager for the Panhandle region of Idaho Fish and Game. Hello, TJ.
Hello, Julie. Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to be on.
I know it. I'm looking at you via Zoom and it's good to see you again. It's been a little while, I think.
It has been a while. You probably noticed my mustache. That's a little different from last time you saw me.
I think so. Maybe that's a hunting season extra. So many people grow out something during hunting season.
Is. Just comes with the territory.
Boy, I agree. Well, TJ, for the listeners who haven't had the opportunity to hear you on KRFY, just tell us a little bit about your background, how you came to be the regional communications manager here in the Panhandle.
Sure. So I've been with the department for about 12 years now. I've been in my current role as regional communications manager for about 2 years. Absolutely love it. Love telling people why we do what we do and how it benefits them. So I consider it an honor to be able to do that. And I love working for the department. Prior to that, I was a fish biologist. So squeezed fish for a living, tried to make fishing better, and then moved over to this side of doing radio interviews and news interviews and writing newspaper articles.
Yeah, you do write a lot. I see your name tagged in a lot of little bylines here and there. So you're pretty busy. You're a busy guy. Well, all right. And we have a lot that's happening with fish and game. I often try and catch you for a fall update, but this is almost more of a winter update. And so we'll adjust our topics just a little bit based on that. But we have a few good ones. You want to just go ahead and launch in?
Sure.
Okay. Well, the first thing I've got on my list is to talk about the trapping season. And I've got questions, and I bet you've got the answers, but I'd like to know who's trapping these days? Why are people out trapping?
That's a great question. We get that question a lot, actually. And people often ask and say, do we need trapping anymore? It seems kind of outdated and that we don't need it. And I disagree. Trapping, first of all, is a very deeply rooted legacy in Idaho. In fact, it's kind of where some of the roots of Idaho started. And so there's a long legacy of it. It's very ingrained in generations of families. It's very important to different people. And it actually does play an important role in wildlife management. So, as a department, we are charged with managing fish and wildlife populations, and trapping is a part of that, particularly with animals that may be nuisance animals, like beavers that get into irrigation ditches and cause farm, agricultural fields to flood. Trapping is also very important for predator management. Which we do a lot of predator management to keep things in balance and provide opportunity for sportsmen. So people do it for a variety of different reasons. A lot of people that trap, they just love it. It's a hobby like I love hunting and fishing. It's a hobby that they love. People tell me all the time that they feel super connected to the animals because they're learning their behaviors and their habitats. They use all kinds of stuff from animals. I've actually had beaver stew before, and it was delicious. So they're people eat some of the animals that they trap. They use the furs for crafts, they sell them. So people are really into it.
Yeah, and would you say it's more humane than it may have been at one time? Do the trappers work on reducing potential suffering?
They absolutely do. So most people know this, some people may not, but as part of the humane side of things, people are required to take a mandatory trapper education class, which is in person with us. It's taught by people who trap. And there are very strict requirements for how those traps can be set, where they're set, how often they have to be checked. So from a humane side of things, we're very, very engaged with that. And that's a big part of why we do the trapper education classes, to make sure people feel equipped to step into that.
Yeah, very good. I'm happy to hear that. When does it start? What is the season of trapping?
Yep, so it's really mostly a winter activity. So pretty much all seasons are open right now, with the exception of bobcat. Bobcat opens on December 14th, and most of them run through the end of March. Some end a little bit sooner, but that's all in the trapping regs. But it's really kicking off right now.
Yeah, I suppose those furs are in good condition starting right about now.
Yep.
Yeah, So interesting. So that's kind of the trapper side of things. And then what about those of us who aren't trappers, but we sort of don't want to get involved with the trappers' runs or, potentially having a pet or something, get involved with the trap if they shouldn't? What would be good advice for those folks?
Yeah, I mean, typically there's not a lot of overlap with trappers and general recreators, mostly because of the time of year. So people are setting traps in conditions like this when most people aren't out hiking trails and things of that nature. But we've had reports of times that dogs have found themselves in traps, and so we have resources on our website where people can learn what to watch for, learn how to get a dog out of a trap. Those are not very common. And again, that goes back to conversations that we have with trappers during trapper education about, the ethics of where to place their sets and things of that nature. So obviously try to mitigate that as much as possible.
Yeah, and in years previous, I think there was a little bit of news about interactions between traps and pets and that sort of thing, but not I can't think of it in the last couple of years. At least I haven't seen anything about that. So hopefully the education is helpful and working. Okay, so trapping is now, and we're aware of it, and it sounds like it's going to continue on. But let's move on to wildlife feeding. I had a friend who asked me specifically to address this topic with you, and it's because she has about 300 turkeys that live in her neck of the woods due to turkey feeding. And let's talk about that. What are the do's and don'ts of feeding wildlife in the wintertime?
Well, I will start with saying this is the bane of my existence. I hear about it all the time. I see it all the time. And I think the most candid way I can put it is that feeding never benefits the animal. It may be a short-term benefit where people feel like they're doing a good thing and helping an animal through a hard time. But unfortunately, what it does is it conditions that animal to human presence, which they're wild animals. It's not good. And it also draws them near roads, near houses, can lead to vehicle collisions, things of that nature. So across the board, we discourage people from feeding wildlife. There's actually circumstances where wildlife have been fed, such as moose or deer, and they've been fed food that's too rich in calories for them. And that can create problems with the gut that actually can kill the animal fairly rapidly, where they bloat and keel over pretty quickly. So, wildlife are wild, let them be wild is always the best recommendation I can give. Look at them from a distance, enjoy them when you get to see them, but don't draw them into your property by throwing food out for them.
Yeah, and it also draws them together, which isn't helpful, right? We don't want them so closely packed in the wintertime.
We don't, you're exactly right. And we don't have chronic wasting disease in the panhandle. Thankfully, we haven't detected it yet, but that becomes an even bigger topic of conversation if we do detect chronic wasting disease because it can pass really quickly from animal to animal. So we don't want them in big groups. And I think another thing that people often don't think of is there are big toothy critters in the woods that love to eat deer and turkeys. And so if you're bringing those deer and those turkeys into your property by feeding them, it's not entirely unlikely that one of those big toothy predators may come following them.
That is a good point that I had not thought of. That would be a bad situation, and we don't need that. I think there's one group of animals that's okay to feed in the winter, and that would be the birds. That's still okay, right?
The songbirds, yes, but even nestled
Yes.
within that, we also live in bear country, and so if you've got problem bears in the area, they love to get into a bird feeder. So have to kind of balance that and be aware of that as well. That you don't want to be baiting a bear to come in at some point. Usually that's in the spring, so they're already denned up, and it doesn't matter. But there are stragglers on either end.
Yes, right. So maybe a shorter bird feeding season, or just be aware of it if you're in an area where bears might be likely to show up. You've got to be a little careful with that. I couldn't agree more. Even for the birds, they will, when you feed birds, it brings in predators that are attracted to songbirds, such as the raptors, and it's fun to see them, but the birds do pay a price when they hang around the feeder. I've seen it happen a bunch of times.
They do. You're exactly
Yeah.
right.
Yes. It's so true. Well, all right, folks, just remember, as fun as it is to see the wildlife coming in around your house, and maybe you think you're doing them some good, it's really not. And you're really not helping them. It's not a good situation and shouldn't be done. So it's just a warning or a advice that should be given out every year because people continue feeding the wildlife and it's just not the thing to do. Not okay.
Very well said.
Yeah. All right. Well, so speaking of things not to do, another thing that's not to do, whether it's winter, summer, any time of the year, is trespass. And let's just kind of catch up on trespass rules. What is your rule of thumb for being careful and making sure that you're not trespassing on private lands?
Yep. Great question. And I guess I'll preface with saying that the full trespass rule can be found in our big game regulation book. It's actually on page 97, and it's pretty comprehensive in terms of what it details for people. But and before I get into some of the details of it, I think most people today are carrying a smartphone, and Onyx is a very, very popular app that people use, myself included, when I'm out in the woods. And using an app like that, you can tell right where you're standing relative to where a property line is. So just a reminder and a request to people to the onus is on them to know where they're standing and to know where they're headed into. The way the law states it is that if you are going to be going onto private property, you need written permission from that landowner. And that's the, oops.
Yeah, that is the
About
kind
that, I
of the.
just got cut off there. I apologize.
Okay, but that's the long and short of it, really. You need written permission if you're going to be on someone's private land.
You do.
And
And then let me throw in the other part of this is that there's a bit of common sense that flows into this as well, where, because ideally people have marked their property well, but there are circumstances where people own huge swaths of property. And for them to mark it adequately, that you're going to see a marker from any point may not happen. So if you're walking up to a property and you see fences, or you see a cultivated or irrigated field, or you see a residence, as defined in the law, that is enough to tell you, like, hey, this is property that is being managed in some capacity and is private. And so if anything, that tells you put the brakes on. I need to know where I'm at before I step onto this property.
Right. Those places are fairly easy to understand. You know that those are private. Back to Onyx for a moment. It's not free, but it's not that expensive either, is it? It's not
No. It's
that.
not. I have a membership and I pay $29.99 a year. And it allows me to download offline maps so that if I don't have cell service, I still can download the maps before I go out. And that covers me for the whole year. And it's been incredible. You always know where you're at.
Yeah, much cheaper than getting charged with trespass and having to pay a fine or something like that. Really
Absolutely.
worth it. And it's a good peace of mind so that you know you're where you're supposed to be. I agree. So, and the penalties for trespass have gotten stronger, I believe. So we really don't want to do it. No.
No, penalties are hefty, and I also know that our officers obviously are very in tune with this as well. They're watching for it as the population grows. It's a kind of an increasing problem, and so they're engaged with it, and we've got officers out trying to make sure that these rules are being followed. So I agree.
Yeah. And I don't think you can have like one free get out of jail pass. I don't think like you can trespass once and then if it happens again, you get a ticket. I think it can happen the moment you trespass. But
Correct. I
different.
mean, you're exactly right. I will say that in a lot of scenarios, our officers care more about the education component when they're interacting with any sportsman. So if they have the opportunity to educate the individual through a warning, that's great. Sometimes that doesn't always work. It depends. It's a case by case scenario.
Yeah, makes sense because you don't technically get a free pass. So be aware of that, listeners. You just really don't want to trespass. You gotta have the permission.
Yep.
All right, well, let's move on. These were the serious topics. No feeding of wildlife, no trespassing, and trapping was kind of a light one, but this is a fun and lighter topic, and it's about e-bikes. What are they? Motorized, non-motorized? Where can they go? Let's talk about them.
Yeah, this is a, as you can imagine, this is a growing topic. E-bikes are very popular, and I totally understand why they are. They're great, a great mode of transportation, but folks need to know that they do have a motor on them, and it's an electric motor, which classifies it as a motorized vehicle. So we get that question a lot. Can I take my e-bike behind this gate that's closed to motorized travel? The answer is no. You cannot do that. And if you do, you have the potential to be cited for it. And like I said, it's becoming a growing challenge statewide, actually.
Yeah, that's kind of a problem of understanding. You're thinking you've got a bike and it's just got a little motor on it, but it really is a motorized vehicle and it's taking you all over the place. They're quieter than something like a dirt bike or, an ATV, but nonetheless, they're motorized.
They are,
I
and that
mean,
even applies to the ones that are like the pedal assist, because some of those you have to pedal to engage to get the motor to engage, but still has a motor on it. So that
sure.
applies to those as well.
Where do you see the future of this? Do you think there may become trails that are designated friendly for e-bikes but not other motorized vehicles? Is there a conversation about where this is all going to end up?
Apparently, there's not that I'm aware of, at least. And I think it's so new that I'm not sure where this is going to land in the future. I think if anything, right now we're just trying to keep up with the change that is happening. And really, this isn't a matter of trying to restrict access for people. It's just a matter of these are the rules that we have that are set in place for reasons related to wildlife security, to providing different opportunities for people who want to experience the outdoors or hunting in a different way, and so trying to maintain some of that.
Right. And it is hard to monitor it all because people are everywhere and there's a limited number of folks that are keeping an eye on it, conservation officers. So, yeah. But okay. So, e-bike users out there, be aware you are not to be on the non-motorized trails. And that's very important to know it. Okay. You came from fishing before you moved into communications, and I am a fishing freak. I love fishing. So let's move on and talk a little bit about the fall fishing in the area. We thought we might focus on the lake, but if you've got other info you want to share, that's fine too. What's going
Absolutely.
on? Yeah, what's going on Lake Pend'Oreille?
Yeah, so most folks listening to this probably know Lake Pend'Oreille is super unique. It's a gem of Idaho. We recognize that. The public recognizes it. And it grows really, really big fish. The rainbow trout fishing opportunity in Lake Pend'Oreille is world renowned, quite literally. There's about only one other place in the world you can go to catch 20 plus pound rainbow trout.
It's
It's right here
amazing.
in our backyard. It's incredible.
Such a resource. I know it. And it's
Yeah.
going on. And the fishing goes right on through late fall, past Thanksgiving. I mean, it's still happening, right?
It is. Yeah, actually the there's two groups that host derbies, fishing derbies on the lake. And I don't know the official numbers in terms of how big the fish were that won it, but what I've heard from a couple of different folks is they were all in excess of 20 pounds. I think some of them pushing 24 pounds. So big rainbow trout. It wasn't too long ago, a couple of years ago, there was an almost 33-pound rainbow trout caught as part of one of those derbies. So it's a very, very cool and unique experience. And what I always like to tell folks is that opportunity, that fishery did not happen by accident. That has taken a lot of work to get there.
And it really is amazing because I live here in town in Sandpoint, and I'm looking out. I've got a little semi view of the river, which is just as the Long Bridge. Under the Long Bridge, it goes from lake to river, and I think I'm like a mile from this amazing, really international fishery. You could go to Alaska and maybe not catch a 20 pounder. You could go. There are just so many places in the world you could go and pay tons of money, and we have it just out looking around in our from our city. It's amazing.
It is,
It
and it's a
is.
big draw for people. I think it's a point of pride for people. I know as a department, we're certainly proud of that opportunity and happy that it's turned into what it is. Because like I said earlier, none of it's by accident, and we worked with the public and ourselves to turn it into what it is. And so it's cool to see it all firing on all cylinders and playing out the way that it has.
It really is, and I know that there are some potential challenges coming down the road. I know that the northern pike have come in from Montana through the river, the Clark Fork River, and walleyes are in the lake. But at this point, it apparently isn't affecting the wonderful population of the trout, the rainbow trout.
Yeah, I mean, there's the threat there, like you described, and they're present. We're keeping tabs on that more actively, managing the walleye population currently. But yeah, it's all built on the backbone of kokanee. Kokanee feed a lot of other fish, and when you think of kokanee as a pie, there's a lot of fish that want to bite of that pie, and so we're
Yeah.
trying to distribute that pie in a way that makes sense and that's consistent with what people want.
And they're not all fish that want a bite of that pie. There's a lot of people that like to get out and catch kokanee.
Absolutely. We're
Right.
consumers of the pie.
That's right. Well, all right. Since we're talking about the kokanee, we have a little bit of sort of a conflict that's been ongoing for a number of years, and that's at Trestle Creek, which is one of the spawning spots for kokanee. And there's been a proposed development coming and going. I know it was not allowed for a period of time, and then it has come back around. And you have an update on the Trestle Creek property acquisition.
I do. So as of a couple of weeks ago, there's a 5.8 acre parcel at the mouth of Trestle Creek that we worked with Avista through the Clark Fork Settlement Agreement to purchase that 5.8 acre parcel that again encompasses the mouth of Trestle Creek where it goes into Lake Pend'Oreille. That property has been placed under a conservation easement through the Kinicxew Land Trust, and management of that property has been turned over to the Kalispell Tribe. So what that means is that 5.8 acre parcel is not going to be developed, and having access to that land and to the mouth of Trestle Creek ensures that if something happens to Trestle Creek or it gets plugged up or something in the future, if somebody needs to go in and do some work on it, that can occur, which is a huge win. It's a very, very important tributary to Lake Pend'Oreille.
Yes, it is. And this is so interesting and also rewarding to hear about this because what a great coalition of interested parties, the Idaho Fish and Game, Kinicxew Land Trust. To bring folks together and raise funds to be able to set this aside and just really make sure that the kokanee have perpetual access to their spawning grounds. Oh, and the tribe. I mean, it's really something.
It
Yeah.
is, and there were a lot of moving parts, a lot of things that came together, and so it was, yeah, big news to get the news of that 2 weeks ago that everything had closed and it was final, and so yeah, that I think that is a big update.
Yeah, and no lawsuit had to happen, which I think was looming. And
Yep.
so, what a great way to work things out. That is just amazing. That is amazing. Well, thank you, Fish and Game, and Kinicxew and the tribe for working that out because that should really be an important way to conserve habitat for the kokanee salmon. That's great.
Yep.
Yeah, good job. All right, so that's a great update. Now, this is something I know nothing about, TJ, and it's Talk Shop with Fish and Game beginning in January. Tell me everything.
Absolutely. This is one that I'm particularly excited about. And I guess to give a little bit of context, I do what I do for the people of Idaho. I've been in this state for 12 years. I'm not a lifer like many people who might be listening to this, but I care deeply about it. And I care deeply about the resources that Idaho is home to. And look at my kids, and I want them to have the opportunity to hunt and fish in the ways that I enjoy. And so part of why I do what I do is getting that public interaction and being able to hear from the people that I'm serving, what they like, what they don't like, give some updates, answer some questions. And so, in light of that, we have been having conversations here in the office about how can we do that in person? We're putting information out on Facebook, we're putting stuff out in newspapers, but really getting back to some of the basics of we want to be face to face with folks and be able to talk to them and hear what they're thinking and what their experiences are. And so this January, we are going to be launching what we're calling Talk Shop with Fish and Game. So previously in the past, we used to do sportsman's breakfast here at the regional office in Coeur d'Alene. We would host them once a month, but the downside to that is people had to come here to meet with us. and to interact with us. And so under this model, we're going to, this is kind of a pilot year, we're going to go to four different communities from January through April and basically bring our staff to those communities and provide pizza, provide soft drinks, be present to talk to folks. We'll probably have like a, you know, a 10 to 15 minute topic that we're going to present, have some conversation about. And then after that, we're hoping that folks will hang around and mingle, eat some pizza with us, talk, get to know us, get some of their questions answered, vent if they need to. We're just there to be present with the public. So we're excited to roll this out, and that's going to be starting in January.
Yeah, that sounds a lot more fun than taking a fish and game survey.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah, and absolutely. Pizza? Wow, I hope there's one near Sandpoint. I suppose there'll be one in Coeur d'Alene.
Yep.
Okay, very nice. Well, that makes a lot of sense because people don't always like to write in what they're concerned about or would like to see improved. And a good chat with people from Fish and Game, I would have to think you'll learn some things that'll help you formulate your plans.
I hope so. I think we will too.
Yeah, that's a nice idea. It'll be interesting to see in a year, you know, we'll talk again in a year and see how you feel it's going.
Yeah.
Yeah, very good. And I hope the pizza is a good one.
We'll try to make that happen.
There you go. All right. Well, speaking of a little bit more about what's going on and keeping the public informed, the rules and regulations of everything can be confusing. So on our list, on our outline list, we have the 2025 to 2027 fishing seasons and rules. So that'll be not, of course, this year, but the following year. What should we know about with those changes in rules? Is there anything pretty interesting that we ought to know about?
Well, so at this point, this is the very early phases of it. So my hope in bringing this up was to get it on people's radar that this is coming their way, that we're going to be going through the process of scoping the public for what they would like to see, making proposals for potential changes to the fishing regulations. And that if they're tracking with our website or with us on Facebook, that they will see that. And just to be clear, like, we want to hear from the public. We always want to hear from the public. We're here to do what they would like to see done. And I think I also want to say that nestled within that is to assure people that we are listening, and that just because what they voice doesn't happen doesn't mean we weren't listening. We hear from a lot of people, and we're trying to find that balance.
Right. And it's a partnership, and you guys are the scientists and the people with feet on the ground, and folks that offer input may be somewhat involved in fishing and et cetera. So it has to be a collaboration of what people want and really what's best for the state and the fish.
But, absolutely.
Yeah. But that's great that the input, time for input, will be coming, and people should be aware that they can offer it.
Yep, that will be coming in 2024. So we'll be moving in that direction very soon, and we'll be putting the call out for public engagement with that.
Very good. Well, listeners, remember that. And if you've got ideas about what the fishing seasons and regulations and rules ought to be, this will be your opportunity for the upcoming years. Very good. All right. And then another topic, and this one I think sounds fun. It's the Kootenai River Angler Science Program. And this is about the burbot.
It is, and this one's near and dear to my heart because I spent 8 years working on the Kootenai River helping getting the burbot fishery up and going. So I love this one.
Yeah, so yeah, sounds great. Let's hear about it.
It is. So we've got two angler science programs in the Panhandle, one on Lake Pendere, one on the Kootenai River. And the idea with both of these, and I'll talk about the Kootenai River since this one is just now starting up. The idea with both of these is that we do all kinds of annual sampling and annual monitoring where we're putting nets in the water and measuring fish and weighing fish and kind of keeping tabs on the population. We're good at that. We can handle that really well. The one piece that's really hard for us to get at is how are fishermen interacting with the opportunity that we're trying to provide. And so this is an opportunity for anglers to partner with us and help give us information from their fishing trips that help us better understand how the fishery is performing for them and what changes we might need to make or things working the way that they are. And so this program in particular is pretty cool because we're asking anglers to pick up like a creel packet and a logbook so they can get those here at the regional office, North 40 in Ponderay or Far North in Bonners Ferry. And basically that packet has everything that you need. So if you go out and you fish, anglers can record how long they fished, how many fish they caught. If they catch some burbot, there's some stuff in there, scissors and tweezers to collect a little fin clip so that we can run genetics on it. So it's really a cool partnership with fishermen and getting information that we couldn't get otherwise. And I think the best part of all of this is when somebody participates and they turn their packet back into us, they get entered into a free raffle for some pretty sweet prizes, the best of which is a 45-liter Yeti Tundra cooler.
Oh, I saw that online, man, and I'm excited. And then there's some other fun things, like some very neat custom sweatshirts and hats. It would be great to win one of those raffle prizes.
Yeah. Yep. So there's the big one is the cooler. And then, like you said, there's the sweaters. And I think we've got some Yeti tumbler mugs and variety of other things. And so that raffle will take, I think those logbooks have to be turned in May 5th to be eligible for the raffle. So runs the duration of the winter and a little bit into spring.
Okay. So, and you get the fun of fishing for the burbot, and then you might win something. And it can't be that hard to fill out the report, I would think.
It's not. It's very, very simple. We've tried to streamline it. And like you said, you could have the potential of getting paid to go fishing. So why not do it?
I also noticed on the article about it that you really very much want to know about any tagged fish. And I was looking at a photo. I didn't realize that a tag on a burbot looks like a little piece of orange thread or string. It's kind of an interesting looking little thing on them.
It is, you know, it's funny we call them the guns that you use to put those in. It's a little needle, and it's the same kind of gun that, you know, like a retail clothing store uses to put those little T tags in with the price tag on it. It's the same thing, except ours have like a little phone number and reward on them instead of a price tag.
Okay. Yeah. They're very, I mean, they're obvious, but they're not what I always have thought of as what a fish tag would look like.
Yep.
Don't be aware, listeners. They're just like a little orange thread.
Basically. Yeah, and I think the other thing for listeners to be aware of is if you catch a fish with a tag in its back, it's also going to have a pit tag inside the meat of the fish. That's like about the size of a piece of rice. So it's a little capsule that when we catch that fish and scan it, it's kind of like a microchip for a pet. It's the same kind of thing. It's the unique number of that fish.
Is there something that listeners should do with that? Should they look for that and turn it in, or?
Yeah. So if they are fishing and they catch some of those fish and they're part of the logbook program or the angler science program, and this is all in the instructions, that they can include that pit tag, we call it a pit tag. They can include that with it when they turn it back in. And that's super helpful for us.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah. Because it's such an interesting genetic story about those burbot. They had to be gathered somewhere else and reintroduced to the river.
Yep.
Yeah. And so you guys want to know what's happening, if they're reproducing and all that.
Absolutely.
That's right. And they taste good too.
They do. Freshwater cod.
Yes. So remember, if you guys want to get out, if folks want to get out and catch them, they're pretty tasty. They're pretty ugly and they're pretty tasty.
See, that's where I differ. I think they're the most beautiful fish in Idaho.
Oh, there you go. Except they look a little more like an eel than a fish.
They do. They look like a hybrid between an eel and a catfish and a snake, so that's fair.
But they do have a lovely pattern. I'll give you that. They're very
pretty
in that way. And they're delicious, so we've got to love them. Okay, so that's the Kootenai River Angler Science Program. Really fun. I think that's a creative way to get information about the burbot. We got another topic, and this is really cool, the Osborne Overpass.
Yeah, so when people think about wildlife crossing highways, like it's loaded with problems, right? Wildlife crossing streets or highways, especially when you're talking about, you know, herds of elk, like bad for the elk, really bad for people. And so typically and we've got a few examples of this in the panhandle, underpasses where, you know, essentially a bridge that goes underneath the highway. There's one on Highway 95, and those are very effective. And we've got documentation of how effective those are. But something that has been gaining momentum in terms of effectiveness has been the opposite of that. So a wildlife overpass where, you know, you've got a corridor where animals are trying to cross a highway, you identify those areas and build a spot where they can walk over the highway. So it's a bridge over a highway. And so there was recently one that was done in the southern part of the state, very recently, within the past year. And they've got all kinds of documentation of animals using it. Vehicle collisions are going down. So it's been successful. And we have the opportunity to do one in Osborne. There's a bridge that was built by Idaho Transportation Department back in the 60s, I believe, that ended up never being used due to some transfers in land ownership. And so it's been sitting for a while. And it's a pretty cool story because the community was the one that was interested in converting that bridge into a wildlife overpass. So we heard about that and began to kind of explore what that would look like, and have partnered with a few different entities. And I just got news about a week ago that a $250,000 grant has been secured to make that happen. So we're celebrating that. That's pretty exciting, and excited to see where that goes.
That really is exciting. And for listeners who don't know where is Osborne, because it's not the biggest town, I had to look it up. It's sort of between Wallace and Kellogg, right? So it's going to help those animals wanting to get across I-90.
It is. And I actually talked to one of our wildlife biologists yesterday that said this is an area where the bridge is that animals have actually already used it. So the bridge is in existence, and we're just going to basically convert it to a wildlife overpass. So it's in an area where there's already animals trying to cross the highway there or use the bridge. And so, we're excited about it. It's in the very early phases. So implementation is still several years out. I think we've got until 2027 to complete the project. So we're in the early permitting phases and all of that kind of stuff. But things are moving forward, which is exciting.
That's very exciting. I don't know if you've been up the whatever the highway is that goes from like Calgary up to Banff in Canada, and it's quite an area of that's an area of overpasses. And I think they were hoping that animals like maybe grizzly bears even would cross there, and just really the large mammals. And so hopefully you'll get some big animals not getting injured and getting across the interstate.
That's the hope. I sure hope so. And I know that a lot of the research does show that the bigger animals are less likely to go through an underpass compared to an overpass. So,
yeah, interesting.
Yep.
So what do they have to do? Will they plant it with, the sorts of cover that would encourage wildlife to use it?
I imagine, but I think all of that is still up for discussion. So this is basically the news that the funding is in place and it's going to happen. I think the design side of it is going to probably morph quite a bit as we start moving forward with it. But I imagine that things will trend in that direction.
That'll be interesting. Will people be allowed on it, do you think?
No, I don't know. That's a good question. I'm not sure.
I would have to suppose they wouldn't be. We're trying to keep it for the wildlife.
Right.
Right. That'll really be interesting to watch it develop. I'm excited to hear about that. Well, TJ, we've covered a lot. Is there any other interesting thing happening that you'd like to cover, or do you think we're good here?
I think we're good. And I just want to thank you for having me on. I always enjoy the opportunity to talk with you. And again, just anybody listening, just to remind them that as an agency, we're here to work for you. And we are very happy to do it. And we value the same things that you all do. We love to hunt and fish. We're passionate about those things. And we want to see all of that continue into the future.
Yeah, that's a great statement. And it's really true. I've had the honor of meeting a number of fish and game employees in my volunteer capacity here at KRFY. And you're just such a committed group, and you care about people and animals and the environment. And I just think you're a great group. So I want to thank you for the work you do too.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, you bet. Well, all right. I'm going to wrap this up. I'm going to thank you, TJ Ross, Regional Communications Manager for the Panhandle Region of Idaho Fish and Game, for taking the time to come and let folks around Sandpoint hear what's going on. Thank you so much.
Thank you.